Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the question of what can be done to rid this country of a criminal and a possible traitor who has always been one step ahead of the sheriff and today is spewing poison at the lawman who just ended his pursuit without nailing him because, according to a Department of Justice rule, the president is above the law. But as Robert Mueller pointed out at the beginning of his remarks yesterday, then reiterated at the close of his remarks, the American people should be concerned about Russian interference in our elections. Unfortunately, there is one American who is not concerned that the Russians meddled in our elections and will do so again, and he sits in the Oval Office. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, who writes and speaks on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images, joins us to discuss the politics of images in terms of the White House instructing the United States Navy to cover up the name of the USS John McCain docked in Tokyo in case Trump were to see it during his state visit to Japan. We'll look into Trump's rabid rhetoric today attacking Mueller and how Trump and Fox News are operating out of the fascist dictator's playbook by portraying opposition leaders like Nancy Pelosi as being too extreme and outside the bounds of American values and traditions as the enablers lay the groundwork for authoritarian rule in this country. Then we'll investigate the rise of quackery, conspiracy, anti-vaxxers, climate change deniers, fraud, and pseudoscience in this country with Lee McIntyre, a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and the author of a new book just out, The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. He joins us to discuss the need to refute these harmful ideas by explaining what is special about science and why we should value empirical evidence and the willingness to change your mind and try something different when the experiment fails. Then finally, we will examine further the assault on science and the growing belief in alternative facts in an era of post-truth and speak with Lee Miller, a staff writer at New York Magazine who was previously a columnist for The Washington Post covering religion for the paper's front page. She joins us to discuss this growing problem on the left, the far right, and among religious fundamentalists, and her latest article at New York Magazine, Measles for the 1%, Vaccines, Waldorf Schools, and the Problem with Liberal Luddites. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of the Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rules, propaganda, and the politics of images. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you.
And Ruth, in terms of the politics of images, it's pretty extraordinary that somebody in the White House told the United States Navy to cover up the name of the USS John McCain, which is named after the late senator and his father, who was an admiral, and his grandfather, who was an admiral. All of whom had the same name. And this was in conjunction with President Trump's trip to Japan, and the idea being that, heavens forbid, that in the background he might see John McCain's name and perhaps go off script or something. I don't know what the thinking was, but Trump has acknowledged that something happened there, and he doesn't think that the people who did it did anything wrong. What's happening to our country? Well, you have yesterday, you have a very serious and sober guy who may well be too serious and sober, carefully meeting out his words for this very important inquiry that he did, Robert Mueller, starting out by his statements by saying that the Russians hacked into us and it's very dangerous and something we should pay attention to. And then he ended his remarks by saying exactly the same thing, that all Americans should be concerned about Russia. So this is a guy that clearly is concerned about that. But there's one American sitting in the Oval Office who's clearly not concerned about it. So I'm just wondering at what point there is a kind of critical mass in this country that says, enough already.
Well, I think the big picture is that we've got one, the president is not playing by the democratic rule book. He plays by the authoritarian rule book, which I've sustained since before he was elected. And he's just not, everything he does, from the megalomania and the insecurity so that he can't have John McCain, his, you know, seeming arch enemy, his name even displayed, to his attack dog, you know, to save his skin against Mueller. Every single thing he does is legible in terms of this authoritarian, you know, playbook. And the everyone else who believes in the rule of law, from seemingly Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, to Robert Mueller, they are still playing with different rules. And Robert Mueller has become the emblem of the careful attendance to the rule of law. And that has its shortcomings when you're dealing with someone like Trump.
But how do you explain the enablers? How do you explain the Mitch McConnells, the William Barrs, who it's clear now from what Mueller said yesterday that Barr has lied to the American people? And needless to say, the Attorney General was off in Alaska when yesterday the special counsel made his sort of farewell 10-minute remark.
Well, and this comes, it's very interesting because I am writing a book called Strong Men that goes over 100 years of authoritarian rule from Mussolini up to Trump. And one of the themes is enablers. How do these people get to power? How do they get people to lie for them? How do they get them to tolerate, you know, violence and corruption? And what you see is that, you know, when there's these kind of junctures of politics where, in this case, the GOP was feeling very marginalized and upset by everything that Obama did in 8 years, and there it's a kind of mutual using because they're using Trump to get things done that they've been wanting to have done for a very long time, such as, you know, the attacks on abortion rights and all the other things, and also anti-regulation. Look at how many they've already rolled back so many protections of the EPA. So all of these things they've been trying to do, and Trump is the person they see will let them get it done. And in return, they made a kind of pact, which is the classic authoritarian enabler pact. No matter what he does, even before he got the nomination, saying he could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone, and they gave him the nomination having said that and having made it very clear that he is into inciting violence. So once they make these pacts, they stand with it no matter what happens, and then they become corrupted as well. And William Barr is a perfect example.
Well, William Barr might well be corrupted in the sense that he's apparently, his close friend is the head of the Federal Society, Leonard Leo,
yes,
who's very much, if he's not a member of Opus Dei, he might as well be. And there's that connection that maybe they are cynical. They don't care about Trump personally, but they want to keep him around to get all of their judges on the courts.
Yes. Well, this is also, it's happened time and time again, not just with the back with Mussolini and Hitler, but also people like Pinochet, who hired a lot of Opus Dei economists to do his neoliberal, you know, kind of economic policies together with Milton Friedman of Chicago. So there are these recurring patterns. And sometimes, you know, people are already, they have already had an agenda and they see this as the opportunity to get it done. And they don't actually, they start out by saying that they can just control the person in power. So a lot of people thought Trump was a clown. They didn't take him seriously, and they signed on because they thought that he would be controllable. And then they find themselves immersed. And James Comey published an op-ed in the New York Times about Mr. Trump eats your soul with small bites, and you sit there at the meetings and you're silent. And so this kind of moral corruption takes hold, but you're seeing at the same time, in the case of Barr, in the case of Mitch McConnell, rich rewards. They're actually getting done this agenda that they've been wanting to get done for a long time. So it's very hard to get out of it once you start in it.
And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And I remember Comey's op-ed and where you lose your soul bite by bite. And he actually described what it was like in that meeting that he had with Trump, where Trump tried to co-opt him and tell him to lay off General Flynn and express loyalty to Trump. And he said, you know, that because apparently just Trump just only talks about himself and just is in his own world. And Trump was talking to him, Comey, about his fantastic inauguration, how he'd had the biggest crowd in the history of American inaugurations, all of which is insane, of course. And by saying, Mr. President, that's not exactly true. You had much lesser crowd than your predecessor, Mr. Obama. Of course, he would have been out of that Oval Office in 1 second flat. But Comey said that by not saying anything, by appearing to accede to that kind of absurd lie, he was compromising himself.
Yeah. See, the danger is that what we've learned from a lot of these tell-all books and op-eds and other things about Don McGahn and other people is that there have been many times in which the president has only been restrained from doing really illegal things by his advisors. And one by one, they've been booted out, or his associates, including people like Comey. But the scary thing is that sooner or later, the ruler finds the lackeys he need. In fact, he already has a lot of them there. And then once his team of lackeys is kind of, it's never really consolidated, because this kind of ruler tends to have musical chairs and tends to have a huge amount of upheaval and chaos. In fact, that's a recurring theme, that the administrations of authoritarians are extremely unstable, with people constantly being fired. When Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State, he found out that he was fired by hearing about a tweet, and he happened to be on the toilet at the time, like the maximum humiliation. I've read stories about this happening to people under, you know, Mussolini, under Pinochet, under Mobutu, under all kinds of, you know, dictators. So this is a kind of, every single thing Trump does, which is unfortunate for our country right now, has an analog in things that have been done by authoritarian regimes of the past. And once they find the right group of people who are not going to resign, who are going to say, okay, I'll do whatever you ask and I'm loyal to you, then the real scary things happen. And Trump is setting up very frightening things about having a kind of, I think there's going to be a forever war on the border. And he's been training Americans to kind of put away their compassion with regard to immigrants. So we could see very, very dangerous things happening in the country because he is able to make people obey him.
Well, the European elections were not as catastrophic as many people thought. And the dark prince of American politics, Stephen Bannon, who's been over there working with Salvini in Italy and other right-wing leaders, didn't achieve the one-third number of seats in the European Parliament to be the spoilers and to essentially paralyze the EU, which is apparently Bannon's intention. Of course, Britain is still paralyzed by Brexit. So to some extent, he's been successful along with Nigel Farage, etc. But is there a lesson there? Because in the work that you do on the history of the rise of fascists, my cursory remembering of history in Germany and Italy when the fascists came to power was that in many ways the left was split and arguing amongst itself. It didn't seem to happen in Europe. In fact, interesting enough, the Greens made great gains and the Liberals made great gains. The center is not holding in terms of the center right and the center left, and that's true here, I guess. You've got Bernie Sanders taking the Democrats to the left and Donald Trump taking the Republicans to the right. Is there a lesson here in terms of our politics? In other words, I'm desperately trying to find somebody and some narrative that's going to fight back against Trump.
Yeah, the split opposition is something that has facilitated the rise of the right. The split center left, let's say, has always facilitated the rise of the right. And one of the the frightening things that happens, and it's happening in our country, is that you see Trump and Fox News consistently. They've had a message for a while. They talk about the Democrats, even people like Nancy Pelosi, who's no leftist, as the radical Dems, as the angry mob. And they're doing this over and over again. They've been doing this for years. And so what they want is to have increased polarization so that they can then say, well, and Trump even did a tweet where he said, the angry mob is too, the Dems are too angry to rule. You know, they're too extreme to rule. And this is kind of setting up a thing where, you know, you're not going to allow them to rule. You're somehow, you know, this is his blustering as an authoritarian. But this is a syndrome that's happened over and over again in history. As for the results of the elections in Europe, it's very interesting because even in Italy, where the League and Matteo Salvini did really well, the Democratic Party, which is a center-left party, which has no real strong leadership, it's still got about 20%, which means that there's a core of voters who are, you know, not going to abandon them, even if they don't have a very strong program. And I think we can say that about other countries, too. So the question is about passionate leadership. And in our, you know, 2020 presidential campaign, it's really important to have somebody who can, you know, fight Trump on his own terrain in terms of being very charismatic, very social media able, and have a very coherent program. But we're in this culture of images, and Trump is a master of images. He's always been. He's a marketer. So we need somebody who can, you know, fight him very effectively on that same terrain.
Well, but, you know, this goes back to Reagan. You know, the idea is, are we going to end up with their actor versus our actor? You know, Clinton also had the ability. He was very telegenic and knew how to use the media. If George Washington were alive today, he would never be elected because he had wooden teeth. And when he spoke, the wind whistled through his wooden teeth. So that's a difficult road to go down. I'm recalled James Carville's adage that politics is show business for ugly people. So is there anybody that you can see just in the last couple of minutes here that you could? Because I think that this mayor in South Bend, Indiana, is so interesting to listen to. I've never heard a politician speak with such clarity and such profundity, really. I don't know where he stands on the charisma scale.
Well, one of the interesting things is when you started saying, is there a constituency that, you know, wants to move against Trump, and there's a lot of people who are calling for impeachment to begin, just for the value of having the hearings. It's very, very important to do that, and I am one of them. I've written several op-eds calling that impeachment's very important to start as a way of
educational process. Yeah,
also civic education. Also, but there's a Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic establishment are being extremely cautious, and many people are very frustrated with her. And this is a kind of caution of the establishment. And you see, instead, we're having a generational turnover and struggle within the Democratic Party of people like the mayor from South Bend, of AOC, as she's known, a lot of the newer people who came in, even Beto O'Rourke. This is a generation that communicates differently, and they have different priorities to some extent, and they're very impatient around the issue of how to oppose Trump and impeachment. There's a big gap there. So just as, you know, we put a lot of focus on the absolute corruption and ruination of any moral standing of the Republican Party, but there's interesting things going on within the Democratic Party too. They're not going to play out in 2020 necessarily, but there is a movement that's going to be hard to stop.
Well, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of the Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of image. And your new book again, Ruth?
Strong Men.
When's it coming out?
sometime in 2020.
Well, I look forward to it, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the rise of quackery, conspiracy, anti-vaxxers, climate change deniers, fraud, and pseudoscience in this country. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lee McIntyre, who is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. He's the author of Dark Ages, The Case for a Science of Human Behavior, and Post-Truth. And his latest book just out is The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee McIntyre.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Lee. And, of course, I think many people saw the video clip of Bill Nye, the science guy, normally a mild-mannered individual, setting the globe on fire.
Yeah.
And using some expletives in doing so, which was sort of out of character. But I think it underlies his frustration with this war on science that is endangering the planet. The denial of global warming is perhaps the biggest danger that we as a species face.
No, I think you're right. I mean, he's normally a pretty calm fellow, but you're seeing more things like that happening these days. I mean, more people are, scientists are getting upset. When I start off the book, I talk about the March for Science in Boston. In 2017, it happened in 600 cities around the world, and I saw one sign that said "extremely mad scientist," and that's right. There, people are upset and they're scared.
So, what do you think is? I mean, we have a president of the United States who, on every level, is degrading and debasing the office and the discourse, and endangering the country and the world. There's nothing good you can say about him, but. One of his many faults is, of course, that he indulges in conspiracy theories and global warming denial. So how much do you have to go straight to the top to blame us or blame this situation on, or are the roots of denial deeper than that and broader?
I think the roots of denial are pretty deep and have been going on for a long time. And then it reaches up into the Senate, it reaches up into the presidency. So in some ways, they're the consumers of what's been happening. But then, you know, because they're prominent public officials, they also broadcast it and normalize it and make it seem as if, you know, it's legitimate to question such things. One of Trump's tactics is to say, well, people are asking questions or people are talking. And, you know, when he says that about a scientific subject, it really undermines it. It really degrades the way that scientists go about their work. So I think you're right that it's, it's turned into a nationwide problem.
Right, but the way that it's been politicized is so absurd when you think, and you know real scientists, you work with them. Scientists are perhaps the most conservative people on the planet. They don't get out ahead of themselves. They're very, very careful about what they say. And, you know, if they do get out ahead of themselves, like those two guys up in Utah who said they'd come up with
coal fusion.
Coal fusion, right.
Yeah.
They were finished. So how have the deniers been able to suggest that somehow scientists are making stuff up and getting ahead of themselves in, you know, as though they're political polemicists as opposed to careful, cautious scientists?
It's a good question. I mean, what the motivations are. In some moods, I wonder if the people who are denying the science actually believe it or if they're just being cynical about it. But in other moods, I understand, know that they believe every word of it. So I think that one thing that happens is this. If you're an ideologue, you know, if you believe something so strongly that you're not going to question it no matter what, and then a scientist has a study that shows that your belief is wrong, well, you don't want to give up that belief. But then the thing that might happen psychologically is it might be very easy for you to suppose that, you know, other people are just like you. Other people are, also hold their beliefs ideologically. I don't think that science deniers really understand how science works. I don't think that most people understand how science actually works. And so it becomes easy to become what I call a cafeteria skeptic. They go through and they question the things that they feel strongly about that conflict with something that they want to believe, but then they don't question other things. So they'll question climate change, they'll question vaccines, but then they'll get an MRI or go in for chemotherapy, or they'll get on a plane. They don't question science where it doesn't clash with what they want to believe. They only question it when it's when it serves their interest to do so.
And again, I'm speaking with Lee McIntyre, who's a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. He's the author of Dark Ages, The Case for a Science of Human Behavior and Post-Truth. And his latest book just out is The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. So I'll just quote a little bit from you and I'll get into what you mean by the scientific attitude. You say that I wish scientists would stop being so embarrassed by uncertainty and instead embrace it as a strength rather than a weakness of scientific reasoning. The scientific attitude allows us to be open to new ideas, even while we must remain skeptical of them until they have been thoroughly tested. That is a model of true skepticism. So what do you mean by the scientific attitude?
So the scientific attitude, which is, of course, is the name of the book, I think that that's what's actually distinctive about science. It's not a method or a procedure or a logic of science. It's the values that scientists bring to their work. The first part of the scientific attitude is simply to care about evidence, to make up your mind based on what the evidence tells you. And the second part of it is to be willing to change your mind about your beliefs based on that evidence. That's really the crucial part of it, the second part. And if you think of ideologues, you think of people who maybe they're not basing their beliefs on evidence in the first place, but on what they want to believe, they're not really practicing the scientific attitude. Scientific attitude means that all your empirical beliefs about the world are in some sense tentative, and you have to be willing to give them up when the data show that that they're not correct. That's a wonderful thing about science, and it's rare, and I wish it would be something that scientists would say more about.
Well, you have to admit, I think, Lee McIntyre, that the growth of denial and quackery and creationism and alternative facts and fake news and the anti-vaxxers, it's a real phenomenon. And it's sort of hard as I through my radio program, I'm trying to build a reality-based community in post-truth America.
good for you. I mean, somebody's got to do it. That's that's good. I went out. So I'm not just writing about this, but I'm trying to have conversations with science deniers. And in November 2018, I bought the badge and I went out to the Flat Earth International Conference in Denver, Colorado, and I met some science deniers. And I'm here to tell you they were absolutely serious about their beliefs, and I didn't convince any of them, but I went in there with the idea that they weren't really going to be convinced by evidence, but I wanted to challenge their reasoning strategy, because my idea was that flat earthers and climate change deniers and anti-vax folks all in some sense are using the same reasoning strategy, and I wanted to see that strategy in its most elemental form. Flat earth is the most elemental form of science denial there could possibly be, and come back from that with the idea of thinking about strategies for how to talk to people who are rejecting science.
Well, it is it's sort of infecting journalism, as I mentioned, not just endangering people's lives with this measles outbreak, for example. And how do you explain, for example, the anti-vaxxing phenomenon, which is resulting in measles epidemic, being more often than not the anti-vaxxers are, you know, affluent, educated people. You know, Marin County and places like that tend to be where a lot of this stuff began and spread. Of course, ultimately, it's about selfishness because, you know, you're imposing your sort of ideas that holier-than-thou kind of ideas on the broader society, and because of the herd immunization that's necessary to make vaccinations work, you're actually endangering the lives of newborns who, if they don't die from measles, they can have lifelong brain damage. So to that extent, I find it deeply irresponsible and quite appalling. But as I say, if you meet these people, they seem like nice, sincere people.
They do, and I think that the way to explain it is they're, for with anti-vaxxers, I think they're scared. But the question is, really, with a belief like that, who do they trust? Where are they getting their information from? If they're trusting the wrong sources, it's easy to get whipped up into a state where they're believing falsehood. I mean, the original study, the 1998 study from Andrew Wakefield, has been debunked and discredited. I mean, he was shown to be a fraudster, but still the anti-vax crowd is believing that. Part of it is because they're afraid, as I said. Part of it is because they're getting bad information. You mentioned the problem that some of them are very well-educated, affluent people. That fits. I mean, Socrates all those years ago said that false knowledge was a greater danger than ignorance. And research has borne that out. When somebody is a little bit educated about a subject, they're much harder to convince. The work on the backfire effect from Brendan Nyhan years ago showed that people who knew a little bit about a topic were much, much harder to convince than people who were ignorant about it. And in fact, that the false ideas could backfire if you presented them with evidence that their beliefs were wrong. They would hold them more strongly because they were smart enough, they were educated enough to figure out how to rationalize their beliefs. So it's a heck of a problem to try to convince somebody who knows a little bit about a subject. It's a real challenge.
Well, doesn't that fall into the category of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing?
I think so, and the way to handle that, I think, is to be patient, to listen. The example that I've been thinking about recently is how they're handling the anti-vax crisis in Clark County, Washington, where they're sending out public health officials to have workshops and sometimes one-on-one conversations with anti-vax folks, and they're changing some minds. I read an account of this in the Washington Post not long ago, where one woman said that she changed her mind on anti-vax because she had a two-hour conversation with one of the scientists who was the first person to really listen to her, to really listen to the doubts and worries that she had. And that I think that's borne out by the research. You convince people by one-on-one engagement, through stories, through listening, through building trust, not through presenting evidence or denigrating them or calling them names or something. It's really the only way to convince somebody is to engage them and to really be patient with them.
So your book makes the case that the people, these skeptics and pseudoscientists and ideology-driven denialists who reject scientific findings, that a way to deal with it in terms of turning this thing around, and as I mentioned earlier, it does feel like the tide is running against science with fake news not just infecting journalism but infecting education itself. You're arguing that social science should embrace the scientific attitude along with, of course, natural science. So explain that. The cure. In other words, I'm looking for a cure here.
Well, the social sciences have been in bad shape for a long time. I wrote Dark Ages, which is about the social sciences, in 2006. And the social sciences have always been trying to live up to the standard of the natural sciences and not doing such a good job of it. I think there's good social science out there, but I think it's easy for social science in particular to be politically biased, for people to know in advance of doing a study what it is that they want the study to show. And the good news, the way out of it, is to follow what happened with medicine. I've got a chapter in the book where I talk about the history of medicine. And if you look at what happened with medical care in about the 1840s through the 1860s, they underwent a revolution, a scientific revolution, where they started to embrace the scientific attitude. It used to be that medical knowledge, medical treatment and practice was based on folk wisdom and instinct and just what any individual practitioner thought. It really became a science in a two-decade span following that. And it was because they embraced this community ethos of checking one another's work against the evidence and raising the standards of the profession. That's really what made the difference. Same thing can happen in the social sciences. Again, I don't want to paint it too broad a brush because there is some good social science out there. I do talk about it in the book, but I think there's some ideologically driven social science as well.
Well, do you think, though, that in the media, in journalism, a part of the problem is this convention of, on the one hand, on the other hand, this
yes.
binary idea that in the universe of discourses, there's two. There's a black and a white version. In other words, you have the Democratic version, then the Republican version, or how it's translated into science is, you know, it's allowed an opening for creationism to be an equal and opposite balance to Darwin. And that's, and of course, it's allowed these global warming deniers an opening because you've got 99% of the scientists saying it's real, but we have to be fair and balanced, so let's have a bunch of 1% quacks on spewing their disinformation. So how much do you think the media convention is contributing to this problem?
It can be a disaster. And I mean, if you look at some of the previous coverage on the vaccines and on climate change, this sort of false equivalence where you put a scientist on a split screen and, you know, then a denier on the other, you give them equal time, let them talk, and then, you know, turn to the audience and say it's a controversial issue, you decide. That's a terrible way to cover science. I understand the convention in journalism, kind of the idea of get both sides of the story, but what do you do when one side of the story is a lie? What do you do when one side of the story has no credibility? I often say that the halfway point between the truth and a lie is still a lie, and it's misleading for journalists to pursue objectivity in, you know, through just telling both sides of the story without putting it in context, because that creates a different kind of bias, what the Columbia Journalism Review once called information bias, where you leave the listeners or readers not understanding the issue because they're hearing both sides and they're thinking, oh, well, they're both equally credible, when that's not the case. It's changing. The BBC now will not have people on who are climate change deniers. Once the anti-vax got bad enough that the measles outbreak started to happen, you saw many fewer of the split-screen debates. But it's still sort of appalling the way that the media covers science, because I don't think that it's doing right by the audience. To create controversy where there isn't one. I mean, if people are looking for a story, you know, I understand that they want to have something to hold their audience. But as I said, that's a disastrous way to cover science.
Well, Lee McIntyre, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lee McIntyre, who's a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. He's the author of Dark Ages, The Case for a Science of Human Behavior and Post-Truth. And his latest book just out is The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining further the assault on science and the growing belief in alternative facts in an era of post-truth. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Miller, who's a staff writer for New York Magazine and author of Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. Previously, she was a former senior editor of Newsweek magazine and a columnist for The Washington Post, where she was an award-winning senior special writer covering religion for the paper's front page since 1997. And her latest article at New York Magazine is Measles for the 1%, Vaccines, Waldorf Schools, and the Problem with Liberal Luddites. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Miller.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Liberal Luddites, that's a new one. I know there are a lot of science deniers and climate warming deniers and fraudsters and pseudoscience is on the rise. Fake news is on the rise. It's very difficult to sort of belong to the reality-based community in post-truth America. But it is very paradoxical that, you know, reasonably affluent, educated people seem to be, you know, at the forefront of this dangerous denial, this anti-vaxxing movement, which is ultimately very selfish because you're basically placing your beliefs above the health of an infant who, if an infant is contracts measles, they could die. If they don't die, they could end up with permanent brain damage. So there's an element of selfishness in this, at least to my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is this idea, there's a kind of paranoia, mistrust of authority, mistrust of doctors, experts, government agencies, information that knows no political party, right? I mean, this is happening both in the left and in the right. It used to be that you could go to your pediatrician, the pediatrician would say it's time for your kid's shot, you would get the shot, you would think you were doing something generous, wise, miraculous, in keeping with progress, in keeping with our social contract. And now when the pediatrician says it's time for a shot, a lot of liberal parents, not just vaccine deniers and vaccine refusers, but friends of ours, look at the doctor and think, what isn't he telling me? What do I need to know? How should I be suspicious? Is there an alternative? Is there a way to get out of this? What are the toxins and poisons that are foreign substances that, you know, are coming along with the injection? And I think the anti-vaccine movement is just kind of a further extension of that suspicion, that suspiciousness, that is really rampant everywhere against authority, suspicious of experts, yeah.
Well, there are some reasons to feel that Big Pharma is corrupt. Look at the Sackler family and how they've enriched themselves and at the expense of hundreds of thousands of fellow Americans who have died from OxyContin addiction. But what's odd about these pockets of anti-vaxxers is you've got the ultra-Orthodox in Brooklyn and you've got survivalists belonging to the political right, I guess up in Washington State and other places. And then you've got the Waldorf schools.
Right.
So and have you written extensively about them? So walk us through. Let's start with the Waldorf school. What is
right.
going
so,
on?
Right. So, I mean, Waldorf schools are sort of appealing alternatives to people who don't want the sort of cookie-cutter institutionalized public school education, right? They offer an arts-based, nature-based, retro, simple, hands-on, project-based approach. They don't like standardized tests. They encourage unconventional kids. And people who are looking for an escape from, you know, testing, big class sizes, all the pressure, all the stress, linear ideas of achievement are very attracted to Waldorf schools. And then these also tend to be people who eat organic food and experiment with natural and homeopathic remedies and would prefer not to give their children Tylenol antibiotics. And so it's a cultural thing. And the schools themselves, although they say they follow the law, do tend to harbor, shelter a really large number of left-wing vaccine refusers. So in some schools, the level of vaccine compliance is as low as 7% or 20%. Or 30%. So that means that, you know, fully 70% of the kids in the school are not vaccinated. That's a really high number. It's a high and very dangerous number if you're talking about something like measles, which is so contagious.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Miller, who's a staff writer at New York Magazine and author of Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. Previously, she was a former senior editor of Newsweek magazine and a columnist for The Washington Post, where she was an award-winning senior special writer covering religion for the paper's front page since 1997. And her latest article at New York Magazine is Measles for the 1%, Vaccines, Waldorf Schools, and the Problem with Liberal Luddites. So describe the scene the Rockland County Courthouse, where the parents from the Green Meadows School, which is a Waldorf school, showed up.
Right. So what had happened was that in December of last year, the county commissioner had in Rockland County had looked around at, you know, which schools had the lowest vaccination rates. There was a measles outbreak in Rockland, and he says he was trying to contain the measles outbreak. And so he said, you know, which schools have the lowest vaccination rates? The unvaccinated kids have to stay home. And the Waldorf School was included in this group of yeshivas, of schools where these very, very Orthodox Jews were sending their kids to school, and they were shocked. They were shocked. They were aghast. They were outraged. And the school decided to keep the kids at home, like to tell the kids who weren't vaccinated to stay at home. And the parents really were furious. They felt like the county commissioner was breaking the law, that that there had not been a single case of measles in their school, that their kids were perfectly healthy, that their kids were being targeted and punished by the county commissioner for the wrongs that another group of people were doing. And so they hired a lawyer, and they hired a very, very fancy, decorated, prestigious lawyer to fight their case for them. And he tends to be a sort of civil liberties lawyer. And so on the day that I went to court with them, I saw, you know, this very eminent lawyer fighting on behalf of these parents who'd kept their kids out of school for 4 months rather than immunize them against measles with a shot. And they were so stressed out and so tense and so badly wanted the judge to say, you know, you're right, the county is wrong. Go ahead. You know, the kids had already gone back to school at that point, but the county was threatening to keep them out again. And they just feel, these parents feel victimized, like targets of hate, backed into a corner, and they're so activated and really angered by the situation in which they find themselves.
So in talking to these liberal Luddites, as you've described them, is there any way to get them to understand that in many ways they are, in spite of their left-wing politics, they are essentially in bed with Kellyanne Conway and Trump and company with their alternative facts?
No. The short answer to your question is no. They believe that they're fighting for a personal right, the right to parent their children as they see fit. they believe that they are the best ones to parent their children and to make decisions about their children's health and safety. They resent and rebel against the idea that anybody should know better than they do about how that is to be done. And when you ask them, you know, the way you started at the beginning of this conversation, what about the vulnerable child on the subway, the child who is going through chemotherapy, or the infant who's less than 1 year old, you know, people who don't have the resources to live in big houses or drive cars, can't protect the air bubble around themselves, you know, they say, well, I mean, one of the people I spoke to said, in a social compact, you know, some people are going to get hurt. And they do see it as a risk analysis. You know, they're choosing the risk of getting measles over the risk of vaccination. And they do see that there's a chance that, you know, their sick child might infect or affect another child. But they also believe that their own personal rights to raise their children as they want to supersede that.
But do they understand that the genesis of their belief system comes from a fraudster, Wakefield, who's thoroughly discredited, what got disbarred, or whatever you, in
no.
medicine you get?
No,
you
know. No, no. They see all of the numbers and the data coming from the government, coming from the CDC, coming from the World Health Organization, coming from the pharmaceutical, the inserts for the vaccine on the, from the pharmaceutical companies. They see all of that information as fraudulent, and they have their own system of numbers and data that they use alternatively. And, you know, I actually think it's not productive to keep showing them the conventional data because they just reject it outright. So I think a better argument or a better conversation is this conversation about other people's children, because it really is where the risk is.
Well, but one of the canards is this suspicion of Big Pharma, which is, I think, is perfectly legitimate. But the truth of the matter is that Big Pharma are interested in massive profits out of new drugs or old drugs that they suddenly jack the price up on. And that the companies that make vaccines, there's not much profit in it. They more or less do it as a public service. So the whole idea that we're all victims of Big Pharma's malign intentions doesn't apply to vaccines.
That is true. And they will also concede, and this is one of the, I think, the gaps in the argument there, they will also concede that in places in the developing world, vaccines have been very important and very effective and necessary. And so there is this kind of, but not for us, not for our kids, not in our backyard kind of mentality that happens. And when you say, I mean, you know, I live in New York City. Rockland County is 30 miles away from where I live. There, you know, we all live on top of each other. So we're not protected. And any illusion of being protected is a fantasy, in my opinion. And so although it's true that, you know, an affluent, privileged family that lives in the suburbs and has a nice house and good access to medical care and good sanitation and nutritious food, even if that child does get measles, he or she is likely to more than survive it, be completely fine. The fact is that we're all living in very close proximity to one another, and the likelihood that that child can come in contact with a child who is less privileged and has less access to child care and is more vulnerable for a lot of different reasons is very high. So, you know, so they're willing to say it's fine for Africa, it's fine for the Philippines, it's fine in these places in the developing world where it's really necessary, but not for us. And that's where I think the argument really falls apart.
But is there any recognition of history, and it's not that long ago that people contracted polio, that we had a president of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, who was, you know, incredibly healthy guy until in his 20s he contracted polio and was a three-term U.S. president. As I say, it wasn't that long ago. So how do anti-vaxxers deal with the fact that polio was eradicated? And of course, if you go back further, kids in died of all kinds of diseases that are now prevented through vaccination. It was just the way life was. You know, most families lost kids. So we are in a very different world where kids, you know, it's not the expectation that you lose at least one or two of your kids.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, and I feel the same way about childbirth, actually. I think, you know, it's safer to have your kid in the hospital than at home. Women, babies died all the time in childbirth 100 years ago. But there is this idea, and it's not that far from the you know, MAGA idea, the Make America Great Again idea, that things were better before. Things were better before when things were simpler. There's a fantasy about an agrarian culture. And, you know, what these parents in particular are reacting to are sort of understandable forces of, you know, politics and capitalism and greed and corruption that are sort of undeniable. But the reaction has been sort of a retreat from the world and from the realities of the world. And that is potentially dangerous, not just to their own children, but to all of our children.
Well, just in closing, what's the failure here, the societal failure, in terms of, I mean, we don't seem to teach critical thinking in schools anymore, and I think you have to start young with that. I think our media, because it operates on the idea of, on the one hand, on the other hand, you have the Democratic point of view, then you have the Republican point of view, and that's allowed creationists to equate their quackery with evolution, and it's allowed global warming deniers to equate their quackery with the main consensus of 90%+ of scientists. So to some extent, the media also seems to be at fault here.
I agree with you there, too. I do think that this binary, dualistic way of talking, good guys, bad guys, right and wrong, is really problematic, and it's problematic in the media. And it's also, I spoke to many, many epidemiologists for my story, and their response to the anti-vax movement is, you know, these people are stupid, they're dangerous, they're very both condescending and condemnatory. And I think that just makes people dig in harder. These parents I met in Rockland County got dug in much harder when the county commissioner went after them in particular. And so something needs to break in the way we talk to each other about how we disagree and figure out how to have disagreements productively. And figuring that out is way above my pay grade, but I think it's really essential not to just scream at each other from behind lines. It doesn't get them to agree to vaccinate their children. You know, there were families who in this moment did vaccinate their children, and the reason they did was because their children wanted to go to school. Mm-hmm. And they begged their parents. They said, "Please, I need to go to school. I need to see my friends. I don't care. I need, you know." And so the parents relented. They were like, mm-hmm. All right, it's more important for my kid to be with her friends, to get an education, to for us to go to work and not have to worry about childcare, you know. And so there are ways in which you can exert pressure, be convincing, show, you know, a lesser of two evils kind of argument. But I think standing on your side and saying you're stupid and wrong is absolutely not the way to do it.
Well, Lisa Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Miller, who is a staff writer at New York Magazine and the author of Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. Previously, she was a former senior editor at Newsweek magazine and a columnist for the Washington Post, where she was an award-winning senior special writer covering religion for the paper's front page since 1997. And her latest article at New York Magazine is Measles for the 1%, Vaccines, Waldorf Schools, and the Problem with Liberal Luddites. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.